Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Kendall, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in over 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. The Hinckley is also pleased to announce that we will host Malcolm Gladwell on November 5th at 8 p.m. If you would like tickets, you can go next door for more information. You may also visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu. The title of today's forum is Restorative/Therapeutic Justice, A Need for Alternatives to Traditional Prosecution. Today's guest is District Attorney Sim Gill. He was elected as Salt Lake County District Attorney in November 2010. As a veteran prosecutor, Sim has been a champion of issues on therapeutic justice, criminal prosecution, and alternatives to prosecution. He has long been an advocate of taking a systems approach to the issues of criminal and social justice, focusing on collaborative and community-oriented approaches to problem solving. He graduated from the University of Utah with a bachelor's in history and philosophy. He received his JD degree and certificate of specialization in environmental and natural resources law from the Northwestern School of Law at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Thank you, Kendall. Thank you, Professor Chambliss, for inviting me to come down and speak with you. The format I'd like to do is, as the topic suggests, you know, we want to talk about restorative justice and alternatives to incarceration. And I'd like to maybe speak for about maybe 30 minutes or so, maybe 40 minutes, and then maybe open that up for question and answer, because I think it's really important to answer your questions. And there's a lot that I want to talk about, so try to focus on some very narrow set of issues. You know, we talked about, you know, the topic is about restorative justice. So let me sort of tell you, sort of give you some definitions, and I want to sort of have you have our conversation today with these ideas in mind. Restorative justice, really what it means to me is that when crime happens, it causes injuries to victims, offenders, and the communities where crime occurs. Justice, then, is the repairing of all those injuries. And when I talk about therapeutic justice, the question that I want to pose is, the hypothesis I want to suggest is that we should be looking for treatment options rather than incarceration options to address the core issues contributing to the pathways to criminal justice system as a whole. And that really is housed in broader conversation issues, and which I want you to think about and maybe take away from it, is what are our responsibilities in the context of social and political justice? What are the policy decisions that we are making, or more importantly, not making, that are contributing to the conditions that are producing dysfunctions in our society that rely then upon the criminal justice system to address them? And finally, I want you to sort of think about the criminal justice system as a really system, because it is not the simple province of a prosecutor or a legal defender or a judge, but it is actually a collection of all these folks in a systemic approach. So it has prosecutors, legal defenders, and that is, there are multiple stakeholders in the criminal justice system as a whole, and they depend on the function of these different participants in order to either give us success or failure as a system. So why talk about these issues, especially from a prosecutorial perspective and from a criminal justice perspective? Well, let me suggest to you that we start, when we think about crime, we think about punishing people, holding people accountable. And from a sort of a social conversation, we are also seduced by a notion called zero tolerance. You know, when you talk about law enforcement and you talk about prosecution, it's an idea that we want to be really tough on crime. We want to hold those offenders accountable. We want to lock them up. And although zero tolerance is a great soundbite at the 6 o'clock news, it's really very poor public policy when we talk about our approaches to criminal justice. And it functions on some flawed assumptions. So some of the assumptions are that, you know, you have unlimited resources, that you have a limited number of cases, and you have unlimited time. So the theory really is that if I spend enough money at a particular problem long enough, somehow we will magically solve it. And I can tell you as a public prosecutor, as a person from who represents a public institution, I know of no public institution where those assumptions are met, especially in the resource scarcity that we have. So the other alternative may be that we ought to start thinking about smart prosecution and rather than just simply zero tolerance. And so in a world of competing agendas and policies and politics, can we even come to an understanding of what that smart prosecution may look like? Now, we have a lot of policy concerns. We have a lot of political discussions. So let me submit to you what I think the right answer, even though we may come from different political spectrums or we may have different policy perspectives, but if we were to think about, say, what the right answer in criminal justice might look like, I would suggest to you that it would have these features, whatever that right answer might be. It can't cost us more than the current system is costing us. I think that would be what the right answer would look like. The other thing is that whatever that right answer is, it cannot compromise on traditional law enforcement values, right? Which is we want to focus on reduction in crime. We want to impact maybe certain specific criminality. We want to make sure that we adopt the public policy and issues that address those criminal justice issues that are of concerns in our community. The third thing it must do is it must yield results that can be measured and be demonstrated beyond anecdotal reports, beyond what the current system is producing. So it has to give us better outcomes. It has to give us better conclusions. So they should be measurable outcomes. They should be better outcomes than the current system in its form is producing or failing to produce. The other thing I think that right answer would look like it is that it must impact the totality of the model. It must be capable of duplication. It can't be simply be isolated to this one particular issue, but can it be replicated beyond Salt Lake County? Can it be replicated in New York City? Can it be replicated in Florida or different places if we're going to really look at it as a criminal justice issue? And finally, that it really needs to be data-driven. It should be based on best evidence. It should be based and it should be supported by research, because we need to get away from this idea of an emotional response to crime. What we really want to be looking at is that is there good solid research that supports it, and we should be utilizing methodologies that are research-based and data-driven. Now, I think that's what the right answer would look like to address a problem. So what's the problem? So what is the problem currently in our criminal justice system? Well, let me tell you what the problem is. We are bursting at the seams in our criminal justice system. We are depleting our resources. We are trying methodologies that are not producing those results that we want. And it is frustrating to both to our community, to our law enforcement, and ultimately it should be frustrating to you as the citizens of this country. Because ultimately, all of you are going to contribute through your tax dollars to the policy commitments that we're going to be making, and it should be of some concerns to you. So let me sort of contextualize what that problem I see to be. We lead the world in one unfortunate category. We jail more human beings in the United States of America than any other country in the world. Right? United States, U.S. is number one. China is number two, Russia is number three, and Cuba is number four. And let me pause there for a second. Do you see some irony there? Because the irony here is that we, the most freest country in the world, that has been our historical lineage, right, are ahead of, if you look at the 20th century, three of the most repressive totalitarian regimes historically that we've recognized in history. And I'm not talking in terms of just some rough ratio or prorated numbers here. What I'm really talking about here is in actual headcount. So think about it for a second. Think about the population of the United States of America, 360, 370 million, and think about the population of China, well in excess of 1.2, 1.3 billion people. We actually jail more people in net headcount than China does. You know, and when we look at it, how did we get here? So when we think about it, from 1970 to 2005 and continuing beyond 2005, there was almost a 700% increase in our prison population. We went from jailing about 190,000 federal and state prisoners to in excess of over 1.5 million prisoners, And when you add to that over 750,000 prisoners and inmates in our local jails, we easily exceed over 2 million prisoners. In addition to that, we're going to have over 10 million people who will be processed through our local jails. And more than 4 million people are going to be ex-convicts. And this desire to incarcerate that we've had in our country is not without its cost. We've gone from 1980 on to 2005, 2008. We've gone from spending about $8 or $9 billion a year, and we will be exceeding well over $60 billion a year to prop up the infrastructure that we've created to house all these people. So corrections spending, the people who are engaged in this process from 1982 to mid-2005 increased over 570%. So we're spending, we're locking more people up, and we're spending all this money, all of your money. And what do we get back in return for that? What we get back in return for that is that more than half of the released prisoners will be behind bar within 3 years. And of the 600,000 admitted into the prison each year, over two-thirds of these will fail to complete probation or parole. So for all the money that we're spending, we cannot even get the return on investment that we're making in terms of recidivism rates. So if we're spending this money to lock all these human beings up, our fellow citizens, and we're spending it for a longer period of time, we're not even getting the results. In fact, even we've had historic drops in crime rates, our incarceration rates, on the other hand, continue to go up. So there's a disconnection with that. So who's getting locked up? So who are all these people that are ending up in our prisons and our jails? You know, as I look at it, there are what I call, I can identify four pillars, if you will, of four categories of people. Now, of course, I'm not going to talk about the traditional person who's just out there committing crime, person-on-person crime. But if you look, exclude that one person, that one kind of a category, here's what the profile looks like. There are people often who are suffering from substance abuse or alcohol abuse. That seems to be a category of people who are ending up in prisons. There are people who are suffering from chronic mental illness. That's another group of people who are ending up in our prisons. There are people who often have chronic homelessness or come from the margins of economic poverty. Economically, they're the most worst off in our society. They're ending up in our prisons. And then there are individuals who have a history of coming from structures of family violence. And they're coming from communities of family violence and are growing up in part of that as developmentally as children. Those are people who are ending up in our prisons. So when you look at this population and when you think of it in that sense, here's my hypothesis. I would submit to you that this group of individuals are more prone to treatment interventions than merely traditional incarceration interventions and punishment models. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm a public prosecutor, so if you go out and murder somebody or molest a child or rape somebody, I'm going to prosecute you aggressively. I'm going to lock you up for as long as I can. But that's the distinction we have to draw between those individuals who are a genuine risk to our community, a risk to your personal safety, than those individuals who we simply dislike or who we think we don't appreciate their presence in our community. I think that is a distinction that we have to make. Now, one sobering realization here has to be that we can no longer sustain nor pass down our social, economic, public health deficits to the criminal justice system. At least it's my hypothesis that when we fail to act upon our social justice and public policy commitments, and we have deficits in those decision-making, historically, we are then looking to that disturbance in our community, and we are inappropriately looking to the criminal justice system to fill that breach. And that is the most expensive solution to those challenges that we have. I simply cannot prosecute nor jail our way out of this type of a challenge. And this kind of a response is the most expensive response and very poor public policy. So, let me sort of touch upon some very specific examples of how we might be able to address this issue and what some of those challenges are. As I mentioned to you, restorative justice is that issue of where crime, when crime happens, it causes injuries to victims, offenders, and the communities, and it is the repairing of those injuries. For victims, it's about accountability and restitution. For criminals, it's about rehabilitation and treatment. And for communities, it's about costs and safety and recidivism. So can we apply this this kind of an approach or this paradigm shift? And why should we? So let me give you some examples. I want to talk about mental illness. 2 to 4% of the general population is mentally ill. But when you think about our jail and prison populations, conservatively, the most conservative figures are going to be 17 to about 23, 24%. And by some estimates of studies that have done, that could exceed well over 50% of the people in our jails and prisons are mentally ill. And when you add to it substance abuse as a co-occurring disorder, that number is going to be somewhere about 70 or 80%. So when you think about the mentally ill in that context, the largest mental health facility in the United States of America, you know where it is? It is the L.A. County Jail. The second largest, and these numbers, these facilities go back and forth, the second largest is Rikers Island Jail. Third is Cook County Jail. And you literally have to go to 14 or 15 or somewhere below before you get to a publicly funded, publicly accessible mental health facility. So how do we end up in this situation, right? This sort of, how do we end up in this this kind of thing? Well, we started out in the late, you know, 70s and, late 60s, early 70s. We were concerned. We were concerned about the institutionalization of our mentally ill. The treatment that we were giving to them was unacceptable to us as a matter of social policy. And we said, look, we're going to deinstitutionalize all these folks, which was a great idea. So we closed down our institutions and we were going to have community mental health centers where we were going to provide this service as a concerned community. But there was only one flaw. A deficit in our social policy and public policy here was that we refused to fund those institutions. So what happened? The homeless rates went up, medical support depleted and became non-existent, and self-medication by illicit drugs went through the roof. Because now if you're mentally ill and you don't have access to your medicine, you're going to drink yourself into a stupor so you can dull the voices. You're going to self-medicate with illegal drugs because that is a poor man's substitution for medical care. So we had now a flourishing drug-addicted, mentally ill population, homeless in our communities. And they started to engage in petty to serious crime. And of course, when we failed to act upon it as a matter of social policy and political decision-making, then we looked to law enforcement to address this issue. And this, thus, the escalation and the criminalization of the mentally ill and their incarceration rates, which unfortunately are the current reality. And the problem is that these mentally ills, then, individuals are coming into our community. They were circulating through our criminal justice system at a higher rate of frequency, and they were also occupying the most expensive jail beds. Now, you may say, well, Sam, look, if there's a mentally ill person out there committing that crime, what do we care? Lock them up. Because, they, you know, how much could it cost? And I'll give you an idea here. I think we have to look at it systemically. It's just not as about somebody being locked up. So, for example, when I have a mentally ill person who is self-medicating and is causing this problem in a community, there is a community cost. There is a social cost in the disturbance in the quality of life. Whether it's a business owner, whether it's a homeowner, whether it's this person shows up middle of the night at your house or somebody who's urinating on your public prop, on your business there, or vomiting in your parking lot or whatever, there's a social cost there. Then this person, this citizen, is going to call law enforcement, and law enforcement is going to respond. And it can vary a little at different places, but it's going to cost institutionally about $60 an hour to send out one police officer. And they're going to send anywhere from 2 to 4 police officers out there to respond to this person who is causing this disturbance. This person who may be mentally ill and is self-medicated, maybe in a stupor or has passed out, they're going to call the fire truck and the paramedics. And just to get them out of the shop, it's going to be somewhere around $400 to $500. they're going to respond. They're going to look at this person. They've got a medical issue on their hands. They're going to call an ambulance, and that ambulance is going to cost probably $200 to $300. That person then is going to be picked up and transported right up to the university hospital up here. And we'll start the bill probably around $900 and work our way up to about $2,000. And this is before I've even booked him at the county jail. And at the county jail, a bed, a non-medical bed, costs about $72 a day. And a medical bed obviously costs much more. And this person now is booked in. He's going to be appointed a legal defender. A prosecutor is going to have to look at the case. And a judge is going to have to look at this. And while we try to process this case, a mentally ill person without their medication is more likely to cause more administrative violations while they're there. So they're going to have an average length of stay be longer. They're going to be more problematic to be held there. And often, without having proper remedies in place, before we can even get this person to before a judge, often on the petty cases, they will expire out. That is, that whatever I could actually charge them with a crime for the jail, they will expire out before I can even adjudicate the crime. That is our historical model. So then we give them credit for time served because we couldn't get any further. They've already spent almost 6 months in jail or whatever their petty offense might be. And then what do? We release that person back into the community and wait for it. Guess what? We start the process all over again. That is the real cost of failing to respond, and that is the real cost that we're picking up. So what do we do with this? In 2001, we said we're going to have a paradigm shift. In 2001, we pursued a new paradigm, and we said we're going to create the first ever mental health court in the state of Utah as a collaborative approach between different folks who came together. So instead of just simply warehousing the mentally ill, we brought together stakeholders and we said, what about if we talked about the continuity of care? What if we talk about the getting their medication to them? What if we looked at jail not as an opportunity to warehouse and punish, but we looked at it as an opportunity to stabilize and then to reintroduce back? But not just simply reintroduce back into the community, but to be able to hopefully pass this person off to another person who would provide the medical care, who would provide the transitional housing. But not only that, but if we brought these individuals back in and wrapped these services around them, and we made a commitment to change over a period of time, not just for the one time. So we make a commitment if you come into mental health court as a voluntary model, not as a forced model, of anywhere from 12 to 24 months. Because then I want to see you, and you come into court, and we see you on a weekly basis for the next 24 months or 36 months. And the stakeholders, everybody from the judge, the prosecutors, from the treatment providers, from the community providers, from the jail mental health folks, and the medical providers, we assess that person's success or what their needs are on a weekly basis. But also, more importantly, we want that person to come back to us repeatedly. Why? Because the number one reason why the person who's mentally ill stops taking their medication is, hey, I'm feeling good. I'm not mentally ill anymore. So the idea is to reaffirm with them that even when they are feeling good, that they need to take that medication. We don't force people into it. Their underlying crime, they take responsibility for that. So there's that accountability piece. We don't simply warehouse people. We focus on treatment component. And when if we have to intervene, we do it because as a reason for stabilization. We look at Axis I disorders, bipolar, schizophrenic, schizoaffective disorders, and we no longer focus on misdemeanor offenders, but we actually focus on felony offenders as well. 88% of the people who participate in there are post-conviction. That means they have taken responsibility for their criminal behavior. Only 12% are on plea and abeyances. The criminal history of these individuals who are coming in, and nearly 92% had one or more arrests within 3 years prior to coming into mental health court. In fact, the average number of arrests were 9 arrests before coming into mental health court. Average, almost 91% had an average of more than 3 or more bookings within the previous 2 years. And when we looked at this population, we had a study done from the University of Utah. And we looked at a subset of this population that participated in mental health court for a 2 year prior to that. That is, this subset of a population that was now in mental health court, how many jail beds had they used? We found out that this population, the set, the control set that we'd given to them, had utilized 21,765 jail days 2 years prior to that. These people had been on probation a majority of the time. And when you look at this, you would think that these individuals who would come in there would be, because of their mental illness or whatever, and you find some, you got them into this program, they're probably not likely to follow up on court attendance or whatever. And what we found out is that if you give them the medication, give them the support, and even and a long, protracted investment of time, a 3 year is not an easy thing to come every week, okay? And if you do better, we extend that time a little bit out. But 93% of the people made their court appearances. 20% of them attended all of them, and only 3.3% failed to appear. And when they don't show up, we issue bench warrants for them. 60% of this population had no bench warrants. And the reason I'm saying these statistics to you is because in the traditional model, these numbers are off the roof. People have a higher percentage of not showing up, and majority of folks who end up there often will have multiple bench warrants that are issued for them. But here was the most interesting part. That most significantly of all the bench warrants that were issued, that is, you failed to show up and now you're on the run. In the traditional model, once you fail to show up, they issue a bench warrant. Chances are I won't see you again until you commit the new crime or unless law enforcement runs in with you again, and then I have to sort of drag you back. What was really interesting was, most significantly, that of the bench warrants that were issued, nearly half of the people turned themselves back in to the court within 7 to 17 days. And the most common section that we used for these participants were verbal warnings. Only 14.7% were jailed for failure to comply. Now, I'm giving you these statistics because that is showing the participatory success of this. But what was really interesting was when we looked at 7 years of data and we were averaging about 11,000 jail days for this subset of a population each year if they weren't in mental health court. So what we when we looked at them as a seven-year data set, that means that if they had not participated in mental health court, they would have utilized about 77,000 jail days. But what we found out, if you participated in mental health court, we reduced that down to 8,273 jail days. Now, what does that mean? That means that instead of spending in excess of $6 million with this population, we actually spent about $600,000 with this population. But more significantly, the thing that was amazing was that we reduced recidivism rates from 76% roughly down to 16%. And what was really interesting was that if you look at the person who's mentally ill, who doesn't get their medication, we figured that they were going to have what we call an event failure every 243 days. That is, they were going to have a major law enforcement contact. That was extended to 1,341 days. Now, so what does all this mean? It means that if you change your paradigm, you can find a more cost, fiscally efficient model. If you treat people with respect and dignity and address the underlying issues of their medical needs and their social justice needs, you will get a better return on that investment. What it means is that you can still maintain the issue of a law enforcement accountability and meet that goal and objective without putting the community at risk. And those, to me, are all win-win in the context of our criminal justice challenges that we have. The other last thing, since we talk about the Affordable Care Act and medical costs, here was the most important other interesting thing. This was almost counterintuitive. When a person was mentally ill and they were in a mode of crisis, you have an emergency response. So you could literally graph this, that you have a crisis event and high expenditure of medical care, high-cost care, right? Then you go, you wait for another event, another high cost of care. But what we were able to demonstrate and are demonstrating, that you can actually increase continuity of care. If you can give them continued sustained care, you could actually increase the amount of care that they get while lowering simultaneously the amount of money that you're spending on that care. So not only were we increasing care, but we were doing it at a much cheaper level than if we did not adopt this traditional model. The other thing, so that's mental health court, and that's one example. The other example I want to give you to think of alternatives to incarceration or non-traditional ways to look at prosecution, if the goal is to solve community problems, is that, take for example the issue of domestic violence. Domestic violence is a very complex crime, even with an aggressive desire to prosecute, we don't always get the success that we want. So we as a society have said, hey, rightfully so, that if you're a victim of crime, we need to address this issue. You know, 24% of all women will face and experience DV in their lifetime. 1.3 million women will be physically assaulted by an intimate partner each year. And this does not include the psychological and emotional abuse which is in domestic violence situations. Majority of the cases will never be reported to law enforcement. Some $5.8 billion annually are spent as the direct cost of domestic violence. $4.1 billion of this is tied directly to medical and mental health costs that are associated to being victimized by domestic violence. Now, the problem historically we've had is that we have victims who recant, who don't want to cooperate. They're uncooperative. They return back to their abusers, to the shock of everybody. Why is this person going back? And unfortunately, the sad part is domestic violence is a learned behavior. It can be stopped. It does not need to be passed on to the next generation. And that's why it's so insidious when you do it around children, because you're modeling for that and then they're picking up on that. Now, as a public prosecutor looking at a traditional approach with a purely law enforcement perspective, you know, I would say, okay, if I can get that conviction, boy, I'm doing something right. And getting that victim to that point of being part of my team was always a challenge. And I remember early on a situation where I was arguing with this victim. And I'm saying, if I can just get her to agree with me that she's a victim of a crime, boy, I'm going to be okay. So I'm going rounds with her. I'm talking to her. And I think more out of pity than anything else, more out of just frustration, because she probably just wanted me to stop talking, she finally said, okay, you're right, Sim. You're right. I was abused. He abused me. Physically assaulted me, abused me. But I was not prepared for what she was about to say next. Guess what, Sim? He's going to abuse me again in the future. And she said, you know why I stay in this abusive relationship? Because that's the only way I can get medical coverage for my kids. And that led for many of us to recognize that people stay in abusive relationship for a whole host of reasons. They could be economic reasons, they can be social reasons, they could be religious reasons, they could be cultural reasons. Unless we are willing to address the reasons why people stay in domestic violence relationship, the end result, now don't get me wrong, if I prosecute a domestic violence and you're the offender, I want to be able to do that. But how do I get the victim to participate and how do I solve this problem? Simply relying on it as a weak response of aggressive prosecution on those very small number of cases. Well, we had to have a paradigm shift. And the paradigm shift is, how about if we took a victim-centered approach? Look, we as a society promise victims, hey, it's a bad situation. If you're willing to step forward, we want to help you. But even institutionally, we were putting obstacles in the way. Imagine, if you will, if you're a victim of an abused relationship, you finally muster up the courage to walk out of there to get some help. You've got three children in tow. You're in a different part of town. You're terrified whether a neighbor or a husband might see you and report to your abuser why you were in this town. You go to this institution, and you stand in line for 45 minutes only to get to the front gate to say, oh, I'm sorry to tell you, you're at the wrong place. You actually need to go across town. We might as well accept the fact that we failed in our ability to provide that aid that we promised so much to them as a part of our social contract. So we said, what if we took a victim-centered approach? What if we, instead of having a victim go all over town, what if we brought the victim to one place and we co-located those services in that same building? So in a partnership, in a collaborative community approach, in a partnership with YWCA, we created the very first Family Justice Center. The idea of focusing on a victim-centered approach. And then the premise was that if I can make the victim feel safe and secured, make her feel empowered, then she is more likely to cooperate with law enforcement and prosecution to see it ultimately to that end. And if you come to me and give me two options, and you say, Sim, here's your two options. You can either get a conviction, or you can get a situation where a victim is safe and secure. What do you choose? It's a no-brainer to me. I choose the one about making her feel safe and secure. Right? Because if I can get her to leave her abusive relationship, she will take the children with her and I won't be able to pass this on from one generation to the next generation. If she is safe and secure and we address the underlying issue, whether it's economics or whatever, whether it's treatment, then we are moving her, empowering her to move away from that abusive relationship. So our challenge was, could we get people to actually show up? And will they actually follow up for services? So in the pilot project that we did at the Family Justice Center with YWCA, now if you go down on 300 South and 300 East, you'll see this beautiful building with a statue of Gandhi in front. That is the new house for it. But at least on our pilot project that we had done, in about a four and a half year period, we had almost close to 5 year period, we had almost 5,000 victims who showed up to find those services. And we had almost 20,000 follow-ups for services. So not only were they showing up, but they were also following up. Now, I bring that as an example to say that we have to be willing to think outside of the box. That if we're going to take an issue like domestic violence, now don't get me wrong, we still want to prosecute, we still want to hold accountable, but if the goal here is to make our victims feel safe, to heal the injury to our victims, and as a community say that we are on a path progressing towards justice, then we have to think and be willing to take approaches which are non-traditional and alternatives to traditional prosecution. The last thing I want to talk and touch upon is the idea of early case resolution. And I want to give you a different perspective of how we have to think outside of the box. Take our current criminal justice system where people are being charged and they were coming to court. They were being sort of warehoused in our jails. We were waiting for them to adjudicate their cases. And what we had created as a result of this, because we were just trying to force all these cases through, we had created a bloated system. We had individuals who were spending a longer period of time while people were trying to address the issue of getting discovery to them, meeting with different folks, and they were spending a longer period of time while just even adjudicating their cases. So we had this bloated system with a lot of people, and there were many cases that we could have settled earlier, but they were taking long periods of time. And as a result of this co-mingling of cases and a scarcity of resources, we had cases that were dying on the vine from a bloated system. So we thought, how about, again, in a collaborative approach, not necessarily the prosecution, but as a collaborative approach, bringing all our stakeholders together, we said, what if we looked at better justice faster? What if we, instead of having months go by, what if we front-loaded our obligations to these individuals and early in the system? What if we got discovery out to opposing counsel within the first 72 hours of charging? What if we got that information to them? What if we process this person in a different way and faster and get that information out? What if we stop the continuing of movement of these individual cases more than 30 days? What if we identified and even just cherry-picked out nonviolent offenders and those kind of cases and save our resources for the other cases, which are the serious cases? And so that was the hypothesis. So we implemented the early case resolution idea 2 years ago. And what we've been able to do is that we have averaged in settling out, that is resolving, between 32 to 38% of our cases within the first 30 days. And in fact, half of those cases within the first 14 days of filing those charges. So what does that mean? It meant that we've taken these other cases that were bloating the system out of the system, so we're making it more effective and efficient and delivering justice faster to individuals, treating them as human beings. But it also means now we have resources that are left available for us, the more serious cases, the murders, the rapes, the more aggressive, the assaults, those person-on-person crimes. So although our caseloads have gone down, our workloads have gone up appropriately with the right type of cases. But more importantly, it's not just giving us an efficiency that we have to correct this model as we process individuals through, the programming of it. But it's now opened a new conversation. If I can resolve this case faster, how am I going to get treatment to this person faster? It is forcing us to examine our premises, and it is the first precursor steps to do an overhaul change of the criminal justice system as a whole. It is the opening conversation. So now I need to get the assessment done faster. So when they come into the booking, first contact with law enforcement, I want to see if you are appropriate to have a risk assessment done. And if I can get that risk assessment done at the time of booking, then that information is available within the next 72 hours as I adjudicate your case. And as I adjudicate your case, then the judge has that information and we can get the right treatment in place for you right away, early in the process and quick in the process, rather having you wait for 3, 6, 9 months before we would get that to you historically. And that means that we have to change our institutional framework. And I point that out as another different example of fiscal savings and efficiencies that we have. So, why should it matter to you? Why does this matter? Well, it should matter to you because you empower me. I am the Salt Lake County District Attorney, but I represent a public institution. That public institution is not my institution. It is an institution that your tax dollars pay for. And the question that you have to ask is that, are you asking the right question from your policymakers? Are they exercising the right kind of decisions in spending your tax dollars? And are they getting the results that you value and that are consistent with your ideals? So we simply lock everybody up? Is that what your ideal is? Do we want to have a therapeutic approach or not? Is that what your ideal is? I guess I want to sort of suggest to you what I do and how I do it, to some extent, is empowered by you. It is what you tell me to do or don't tell me to do. The last thing you want to do is be passive in this relationship. Remember, restorative justice is victims, offenders, and communities. And you are that community. And the social justice conversation that we have, or the political justice conversation that we have, the ideals that you impose and a checks and balances to your elected official is your responsibility. If the goal here is for us to make a progressively better society, a just and fair society, then I submit to you, you cannot abdicate your role in it either. So, we all have a role to play, and we all have a responsibility to act. So with that, I will stop, and thank you for this opportunity. Thank you.
Okay, the remainder of the time is dedicated to questions and answers. Okay, so who wants to be the first person? Okay, first and last name if you'll identify.
My name is Brandon Nguyen. My first question is, what were the problems that identified what you call as the solution to the problem? What was the systemic inherent structures that of the justice system that alluded you to create these solutions to mental health crimes and domestic violence issues?
Okay, so let me make sure I answer this right. So are you asking what were the challenges that I confronted just in the criminal justice in a whole, or why are we looking at mental health issues specifically?
No, what were the inherent barriers that prevented change to begin
okay.
with?
Okay. Well, I think the inherent barriers, that's a great question. The inherent barriers were, first of all, a myopic existence. We've always thought of, that's why I talk about criminal justice system as a systems approach. Because we can, you know, it's really sexy and has a great sound bite to have law enforcement and prosecution take the lead and say we're out there fighting for justice. But in order for me to be successful, I had to realize that there were a whole host of partners in a systemic way that needed to be talked to and had a role to play. So, for example, law enforcement responds to a community issue. Prosecutors prosecute that case. Probation agents address that issue. Treatment providers provide treatment, etc. Even though I may be very good at what I do, if I am not talking the same conversation with other stakeholders, my best efforts can be undermined by their failure to want to participate collaboratively, right? So all the money that we spend may not give us the same results. So one of the things that we have to do, that's why collaboration, if we're going to talk about, we have to really start thinking collectively as a community, and we need to really think about our stakeholders in the criminal justice system in a collaborative way. So the most successful models are really premised on that communication. So for example, I remember when we're first starting mental health court, we got a room full of people together on around a table, And they were like, well, we don't have money. We can't do this. But I had all these different people. And I said, look, but consistent with state and federal grants that you're writing, if John Doe, the same person that we have to address, shows up on your front porch, you're going to have to spend the dollar that you have on him. And when he goes to the next agency, they're going to spend the dollar that they have on him as well, because that's why we got those federal and state dollars in the first place. But what we weren't getting was a return of any predictable return on investment that we were already making. By us coming together and talking and creating a comprehensive plan, I was able to marry my effort with her effort, and she was able to marry her effort with her effort, and we could also take our dollars that we were spending in a much more efficient way, and we could get better outcomes. So conversation was lacking. This myopic existence saying that only I can solve the problem was deluding us. And finally, we need to recognize, really, why are we sending these people to jail? Are we sending them because they're a risk to me, a real risk? Or are we sending people because we just don't like their behavior, right? If you think about, in California, three strikes, you're out. I understand what the frustration is. The frustration is from the community saying, look, these criminals are coming back and they're still acting as criminals. We're not getting a recidivism. So their answer was to lock them up more. Well, by locking them up more, you're increasing the cost, but if you're not addressing the core issue, then it leads to that frustration. Right now in our community, we're having this broad conversation about whether we want to relocate our prison from down here to a new place, right? It's going to cost us, I think, about $480 million is what they're thinking. Now, when you build a prison, you go through programming, you go through architecture, and I promise you there's going to be extensive discussion about the kind of lights that they put in that prison. Are they energy efficient? Are they not energy efficient? But you know what the irony of that is? We're probably going to spend more time talking about the kind of lights that we have, but rather than the programming of why people are coming into that prison in the first place. Right? Why are we creating the structure that we're creating? We should be devoting as much time to the conditions that moving those people into that. So conversation becomes an important part of it, a realistic conversation. And then, look, I have moved my conservative friends to the center as a fiscal argument. You should ask me whether we're getting a better return on our investment. We should be asking for measurable results. So as I pose to you those elements that would give us the right answer are the conversations we should have. We shouldn't be afraid of the fact that that you want results from me, measurable results. And if I can do it in a better way, in a cheaper way, with better measurable results, why wouldn't we want to do that anyways? So let's have realistic expectations of the dollar that we're spending, and let's also identify the real cost. All of this, in a roundabout way, comes back to we have to talk to each other. We have to understand there are other partners who are a critical part of it, and if we don't talk to each other, it's to our own deficit, and we're going to be wasting money in a failed system. Yes, sir.
My name is Jefferson Campbell. I'm a student here at the U. So my question comes in. It seems like you have the people's best interests at heart. So like when you were talking about that domestic violence case, you would rather make sure that the woman is safe than have the man incarcerated. But a challenge that I've seen and been learning about recently is that in some cases, for at least prisons, it can become profitable for them to have inmates theirs, yes. And a large portion of those inmates are nonviolent offenders. So how are those conversations had with the prisons, and how is that addressed?
First of all, you raise a very, very important point in our social policy debate. I'm a big free market fan, but we need to recognize the role of government is not to be just a part, an extension of free market. Right? There are some responsibilities that we do have as government that go beyond simply, that free market can't address. And my concern is when we talk about, I appreciate the desire for efficiency, but what kind of a culture are you creating? What kind of another market are you creating if you make it into a profit-driven model? I still think that certain institutions need to be public institutions. They should not be private institutions. That does not mean that we should shy away from outcomes or measurements and demand better results from them and better methodologies for them. But that simply means that we need to go back and find better programming rather than simply saying that they need to be made into private enterprises. And that gives me a concern. There are some concerns, like, for example, in some of the southern states, especially in some of the juvenile detention facilities, and some of the litigation that's going on with private management, for-profit management, is that it's being driven by a desire to have certain profit levels. Now, here's the thing. So let's say you become really effective. And in being effective, we're not sending enough people in there, right? That means you have to deprogram. So it creates a conflict to want to have more people in there to now justify the bloated model that we have. So I think there can be a conflict of interest if misapplied. And so it gives me some grave concerns about what we're doing with our prison populations and prison relocation, and not just in the privatization of it. I think that, I was talking with Professor Chatterjee earlier today, and I was telling him, here's another component of our prison. You know, you've heard about political gerrymandering, right? You guys understand, your political science folks. But have you ever heard of the idea of prison gerrymandering? Because here's what we get to do. We have a really interesting impact on political democracy. We're putting people into jails. We get to count them as citizens because they're there. But we're also disenfranchising them in terms of being able to vote. This is one of the other impacts that we're having on our democracy. So we've taken people from urban areas, we're putting them in rural areas, and we're thereby, for example, for sake of argument, let's say this community, this county, this district has 10 people, but 7 of them are in jail. I get to count all 10 for the purpose of representation. But only 3 out of the 10 can actually vote on it through the disenfranchising that we're doing by imprisoning these folks. So prison populations can have collateral consequences that we may not think about. And when you have 1 in 31 American citizens who are impacted by being on probation or parole, that's alarming. But when 1 in 9 young African Americans are impacted by jail or probation or parole, what does that say to us about that population and the disenfranchising of that population in a political sense? So prison policy may have a lot more broader collateral impact than we may be willing to give it credit for, and we need to recognize it may be that may be negative impact as well.
One more question.
Yeah, my name's Ryan Jones. I'm just in the state and local government class here at the U. And I just had a question. I saw that you mentioned earlier just how domestic violence can have a solution just by learning. And you talked a lot about the victims of domestic violence. Now you can move them out of the situation, and then from there that'll kind of stop the progression of children learning that. And I was just wondering from the other side, what, I guess, do you feel would be important programs other than just like prosecuting the person who committed that violence?
That's a great question, because you're right. What I'm saying is that we need to take a victim-centered approach. We need to honor that victim and learn how to solve that problem as a community. And I don't want to take away from here to say that doesn't mean that we compromise on our commitment to hold offenders accountable. We should. And I think that within the context of offenders, I think accountability is appropriate. You certainly need to prosecute and have accountability. But then some may need to be sent to jail or prison. The other ones need to have still that treatment component. Because the worst thing we can do is simply incarcerate somebody and they come back and reoffend. So I think there are treatment options. There are some programs that you need to address. It's a combination of judicial oversight, probation, and treatment that gives you the best result. Ironically, the knee-jerk reaction, the emotional reaction, is just locking people up. And what our research-based data is showing us, that simply locking a DV offender up has, you know, how much impact it has? 0% impact on that person. And so we really need to go to a research-based reprogramming, programming of those issues, and treatment is an important component as a supplement to, if they're a risk, to prison.
This concludes the radio portion of our program. Let's express appreciation to our speaker. Okay?
Thank you.